we swore an oath to the Constitution. I don't think people really mean that. And then when you're getting pushed from the top, from your supervisor, who's getting pushed from their supervisor, who's getting pushed from their supervisor, who's getting pushed from headquarters, which the headquarters level is completely captured. They are ideologically captured.
Welcome to the Daily Signal podcast. It's Friday, April 12th. I'm Virginia Allen, and that was Garrett O'Boyle. Garrett O'Boyle and Stephen Friend dedicated years of their life to serving their country in the FBI. But when they began to push back on some of the decisions that were concerning them within the FBI, they were both suspended. Today, they are joining me on the show to discuss issues of weaponization within the FBI and share their stories about what they saw and what the results were when they began to question their leaders. Stay tuned for my conversation with FBI whistleblowers Garrett O'Boyle and Stephen Friend after this.
As conservatives, sometimes it feels like we're constantly on defense against bad ideas, bad philosophy, revisionist history, junk science, and divisive politics. But here's something I've come to understand. When faced with bad ideas, it's not enough to just defend. If we want to save this country, then it's time to go on offense. Conservative principles are ideas that work. Individual responsibility, strong local communities, and belief in the American dream. As a former college professor and current president of the Heritage Foundation, my life's mission is to learn, educate, and take action. My podcast, The Kevin Roberts Show, is my opportunity to share that journey with you. I'll be diving into the critical issues that plague our nation, having deep conversations with high-profile guests, some of whom may surprise you, and I want to ensure freedom for the next generation. Find The Kevin Roberts Show wherever you get your podcasts.
Garrett O'Boyle and Stephen Friend join me now. Gentlemen, thanks so much for being here on the show with us.
Yeah, thanks for having
Thank
us.
Thank you.
You both served in the FBI, and you started seeing some activity that really concerned both of you. You ended up ultimately blowing the whistle on some of what you saw. You've testified before Congress about what you've seen. Garrett, I want to start with you and just ask you to share a little bit of your own story. You served in our military. You went on to be a police officer. And then you served your country in the FBI when later you were suspended in 2022. During your time in the FBI, you say that you started to see numerous instances of misconduct, of corruption, of political favoritism. Would you share with us a little bit about what you were seeing within the FBI that concerned you?
Yeah, absolutely. So at first, you know, as a new FBI employee, as a new agent, even with my background, you know, I was in the infantry for 6 years. I went to Iraq and Afghanistan. I was a police officer. So I've been in and around government at different types and forms and levels for my entire adult life, really. But like anything, the FBI, is, when you're new, it's a lot of it is new to you. And so it's kind of like drinking water through a fire hose. But very early on, I immediately saw that other agents, supervisors didn't have a solid grasp of people's civil rights, which for me, having sworn that oath to the Constitution multiple times, twice in the Army, once as a police officer, once as an FBI agent, oddly enough, it actually meant something to me. Which I think it doesn't to many, maybe even to most at this point. It's just a job. And they don't take that constitutional law course very seriously that you get in Quantico, which when I was in Quantico, it was fantastic constitutional law training. Mm. Some of the best I've ever had because I've had it in college. I've had it in the police academy. And that was one of the aspects of this career field that was most important to me. And foolishly, probably now, I thought that would be the case for everybody entering into this type of field.
Sure.
And I remember like my first week, another agent talking to her husband, who was also an agent, and they were discussing curtilage, which is like the area in and around your house. And they had a complete misunderstanding of what you can and can't do. And quite frankly, something like that is like very basic. And I am grateful for my background as a police officer because I think I learned a lot of how that is the Constitution itself and people's rights are implemented in a balanced way if you're doing your job correctly. Now, don't get me wrong. I'm a human. I haven't always done it properly, I'm sure. But the goal is to do it correctly. And then in the FBI, there were little things at first. I remember a conversation I had with my supervisor. She had ordered my squad it ended up being a Fourth Amendment violation, and I knew it as soon as she told us that it was. And I let her get through the meeting because I'm still relatively new. I don't want to put her on blast. Maybe she doesn't know. I go back to my desk, and I'm like, I know there's case law for this. I know I've read it before. I end up finding it. I print it off. I highlight the appropriate section, and I go in her office. I say, hey, ma'am, can I talk to you about this? And at that time, I thought, and she said, to her credit, she said, don't do that. And will you just, I'll send out an email and tell the rest of the squad not to do that. So to her credit, she did say, okay, that I didn't know.
Yeah.
As things progressed, I thought, did she just order us not to do that because she was called out on it? Did she truly not know? I had a good relationship with her, so I think it was genuine. But now fast forward like another year, you know, and this is one of the protected disclosures I ended up making later because at the time, it was that slow burn. I didn't know it at the time. And it regarded a Title III wiretap, which is one of the most invasive things the government can do. Mm-hmm. And I had this case, and I'm working on it, and the case was leading me towards this wiretap and leading me to believe, like, okay, this is probably the route we're going to need to go to further determine if there is an actual crime here mm-hmm. or a potential crime. And it was basically a murder-for-hire case, so mm-hmm. the stakes could be very high.
Yeah.
And we're going in that direction. I'm working on the affidavit. She calls me and my co-case agent into the office, and my co-case agent was a task force officer. He was from the Kansas Highway Patrol. He had been a task force officer for like 6-7 years, knew the FBI way better than I did. We go in her office, we talk about it, and she says at one point, I need you guys to get me that wiretap. I need you to. And we wrap up the meeting, and I just remember thinking about that, and we walk out, and I was like, hey. And I said, you know, my partner's name, and I said, what did she mean by that? That's kind of a weird way to say that. And he said, he started laughing, and he said, Garrett, I know you're a cop before, but you got a lot to learn about the FBI. And I was like, okay, can we go in the conference room and talk about that further? And he was like, yeah, for sure. And he was actually the first one who told me about this IPM structure, Integrated Program Management. It's basically the incentive structure for supervisors and SACs, special agent in charge, to meet metrics that are established in the beginning of the year. One of the things on this metric platform is Title III wiretaps. And so he basically explained to me it's gonna be good for the SAC because it's gonna help him meet his quota for the year. Which, remember, in law enforcement it's illegal to have quotas. Like police departments can't have a quota for how many tickets they write.
Yeah. So there was a motivation to meet this quota of a certain number of wiretaps within the FBI.
Right. And so he explained that, you know, for it's gonna look good to the boss, the big boss, the SAC, and it's going to be good for her because then she can put it on her internal resume. It's an FD-954, and it's going to help her promote because then next time she wants to promote, she can say, oh, while I was in charge of the Joint Terrorism Task Force in Wichita, Kansas, I, you know, facilitated one wiretap, you know, and basically just puff up what she did to help the promotion. I didn't whistleblow that till probably a year and a half or more later mm-hmm. because it was another one of those things where I was like, whatever, like it's not hindering me because I'm getting a wiretap anyways. Like she's not forcing me to. I'm headed in that direction.
Yeah.
But then as these things started to, you know, matriculate, I was like, oh, actually these are problems. And, you know, if people watched the symposium, they saw a couple other examples and there are more. Like I have a January 6th example where, and I'll be brief to let Steve jump in too, but mm-hmm. where I got a lead from Washington Field that said, hey, we had an anonymous tip, which in law enforcement, again, the Supreme Court case, it's seared into my brain. It's Navarette versus California. Anonymous tips are worth not a whole lot if you can't articulate what was told to you in that anonymous tip yourself. Mm-hmm. So I start working on this case, if you want to even call it that. And right off the bat, it was clear to me that it was somebody who had a bone to pick with the person they reported on. Mm. And so I'm working on this. And then after like a couple days, I get an email that said I had a facial recognition match for the person who was named in my case. And I was like, what? Because one of the first things I did was pull this is law enforcement 101. I pulled the person's driver's license photo, bald and, you know, kind of pudgy, and the picture that they said was a match was a guy who was probably 100 or 150 pounds lighter with a full head of hair.
Wow.
And I was like, what is going on here?
Yeah.
Well, turns out the person in Kansas City who sent the face to be matched, used a driver's license photo that was over 20 years old. And I'm like, this is a Fourth Amendment violation. This is a due process violation. You're using an old photograph to match it to someone who was, quote unquote, storming the Capitol. And now you want me to further this investigation based off of that when you don't even have the right photo? Mm-hmm. And so I called that person up and they just kept saying, like a parrot, you have a facial recognition match. You have a facial recognition match. And I'm like, what don't you understand about the picture you sent them?
Yeah.
And there are more examples too, but those are just some of the ones I can speak to publicly.
Yeah, so it's just red flags over and over and over. Garrett, thank you just for explaining it and laying some of that out. Steve, I want to ask you, I know your experience is similar, but also unique, has differences. Explain a little bit of your story. How long did you serve in the FBI, and what were some of the concerns that you started to see?
I joined the FBI in 2014. I was a police officer for about 5 years prior to that. And because of that, the FBI sent me to a pretty remote location because they figured I just needed to know how the paperwork worked. But the basic nuts and bolts of investigating were going to be a little bit easier for me to pick up than the layperson. So my first 7 years was in Sioux City, Iowa, as a member of the Omaha Division, was also on the SWAT team, but I investigated Indian reservations, violent crime. And that's a pretty unique little niche in the FBI because you get a lot of repetitions, you get a lot of cases. It'd be normal for me to have 40 cases at a time. Opened 200 cases over my time there, 150 arrests, went to trial 8 times. All these things are incredibly unusual in the FBI. And then transferred to Florida in 2021 to work on child pornography, human trafficking. Arrived in the summer, and we hit the end of the fiscal year, September 30th. And then the executives in my field office, which was Jacksonville, they said that I was reassigned to the Joint Terrorism Task Force and that all the work on child pornography going forward was supposed to be referred to local law enforcement. We were not going to work those cases. And they, in fact, there was a squad of agents doing that they broke down. And at that point, so we're talking October of 2021, so 9 months after January 6th, 9, 10 months. And I hadn't worked on any of those cases, but I am an experienced investigator, and looked at the cases and the way that the FBI was handling them, and they were departing from the rules. Immediately was apparent to me with what they were doing, manipulating those rules. And come to find out, as Garrett covered on this metric system, this quota system, the reason for that departure was to hit the numbers that they needed to have for domestic terrorism. Because in essence, January 6th is one case, one location, should be investigated that way out of Washington, D.C. But instead, they opened a separate case for every single subject. So now we've taken one case and turned it into thousands of cases. And then instead of officially running the case from Washington, D.C., where the alleged offense occurred, they opened the case wherever the person lived. So the subjects and the investigations that I was dealing with were technically domestic terrorists in Jacksonville field office. So now we have the illusion that domestic terrorism is around the country. And I was concerned about that, not for necessarily political reasons, but actually for due process reasons. I could easily envision a scenario where I would have a righteous case and I would go testify, as I've done numerous times in the past, and a first-year law student defense attorney would say to me, Steve, you're the case agent on my client. Did you actually do anything in this case? Because the cases are all actually being still worked in Washington, D.C. And I would have to answer honestly, no. And that would make us look pretty incompetent as a law enforcement agency, which would jeopardize a righteous prosecution. Now, they're not getting a fair process in Washington, D.C., so I think that the FBI feels comfortable with what they're doing. Secondly, and probably more importantly, there was a subject that we were going to arrest for January 6th offenses, and they were going to send SWAT to arrest him. Now, I was a former SWAT operator, had done it for 5 years, and this particular individual had been interviewed by the FBI, said, I'll cooperate. And then we didn't talk to him for 18 months because we were waiting for a director from Washington, D.C. to decide what to do on our own cases. And then they said, go forth and arrest him. And our executive management deemed that this was a proper use of SWAT to arrest this person. And I said that that's an unnecessary risk to public safety and to our safety, and sort of said, we Monday morning quarterback Ruby Ridge, I'm here on Saturday, guys. We're really lucky that we've gotten away with this so far. We should not be doing this. There's other avenues to do it. We can call him on the phone. We can call his defense attorney. We can send a local deputy. We can set up a surveillance ruse where we get him on the way to work. There's all these different avenues that you can go down to bring someone into custody using the least amount of force necessary. We shouldn't default to being using the hammer in search of a nail. So I did that on a Friday with my boss. So that is a whistleblower disclosure. He then started a process where he passed it up the chain of command to the assistant special agents in charge, and eventually the special agent in charge met with them, especially the assistant special agents in charge, extensively, and had a meeting where they said things that were objectively untrue, where they said that January 6th subjects killed police officers at the Capitol on January 6th, which is not true. And so it was clear that they were sort of either towing the party line or they were misinformed. And then they told me ultimately that I had an oath of office, which I cited. I also cited the training that all the FBI agents get at the Holocaust Memorial and the MLK Memorial, where you learn that it is actually your job to throw the flag if you think we're doing something wrong. Mm-hmm. That's your job. And I said, I'm doing my job every time they accuse me of not doing my job and refusing orders. Mm-hmm. And they said, you should set an example for your children and just follow orders. Mm. And I told them that I was not comfortable with it. I left the meeting, and they then told me not to come to the January 6th arrest, which was one of the reasons that they suspended me. 30 days later, they said that I was refusing an order, but I actually followed the order to stay home that day. But the FBI facilitated my suspension unpaid indefinitely within about a month of me coming forward, and use the hack of the security clearance to do it so they can claim that it's not for reprisal against whistleblowing. Officially, it's because Steve looked at the employee handbook improperly. And then the process started where, again, with so many of the targets of FBI investigations, they go after the whistleblowers in the same way. The process is the punishment. You're unpaid. You're indefinitely suspended. You need our permission if you want to get a job. And we're going to deny all your requests for a job. We're going to leak your medical information to the New York Times and tell them that you're actually under investigation for shooting a firearm in your backyard and you're not allowed to talk to the media. Mm. We have an inspection office that is doing an investigation and issues a gag order that says you can't talk about your case with your wife, your family, your friends, or your attorney. I had a compelled interview with the FBI Security Division, and they told me my lawyer could sit at my side and not provide legal information, legal advice, and then they proceeded to accuse me of committing felonies in the state of Florida, which are state crimes, not the FBI's prerogative, mm-hmm. to try to get me to lie or allege that I lied to an FBI agent, which, because in that situation, it wasn't recorded, and they could make any sort of allegations that they wanted. So these are the sorts of usurpations that you experience as a whistleblower. And then ultimately, testifying last May at the Weaponization Committee, the night before the FBI permanently revoked my security clearance and then told the media the night before to discredit me.
Wow. You lay this all out in your book, True Blue, My Journey from Beat Cop to Suspended FBI Whistleblower. And Steve, you know, I think it's just so eye-opening when you hear just that series of events. And, you know, my understanding is, and as you were speaking at the Heritage Foundation of the Weaponization Symposium, and in that conversation, you all talked about how within the FBI, there's actually protections for whistleblowers that because, as you mentioned in your training, they want you guys to be a part of accountability, of holding leadership accountable. There's supposed to be protections for whistleblowers. Where were those protections for you guys?
Yeah, it's supposed to be. They're non-existent. So it's interesting because when I first went to Congress, every year in federal employment, you have to take an annual whistleblower training. And I'm taking that training and I'm taking notes because I'm already thinking, man, my chain of command, they're not listening to my concerns. And so I wanted to do it correctly. And 5 U.S.C. 7211 is the federal statute that lays out who can go to Congress. And it's employees, it's people who have applied for federal employment, and it's people who are no longer in federal employment. So if you got fired or whatever, you can make a grievance to Congress, and that there's a statute for that. In the FBI, 5 U.S.C. 2303 is the statute that governs whistleblowers. 5 U.S.C. 2303 often references 5 U.S.C. 2302, which is what lays out what is a protected disclosure, so a whistleblower complaint. In the legal parlance, it's protected disclosure. And there are five major categories. It's like any violation of law, rule, or regulation, abuse of authority, gross mismanagement, couple other ones I forget.
Risk to the public safety.
Yeah, and then there's one more. And so in the FBI, in the intelligence community, you still have those protections. and are not supposed to be retaliated against if you have what the law says, a reasonable belief that one of those five major categories occurred. And I hearken back to when I was a police officer, my police chief used to always say, you don't have to be right, you just have to be reasonable. Mm-hmm. Well, in our cases, I mean, we had the receipts. And right off the bat, as investigators, because this is the other thing. As an investigator, we both were cops. We both were FBI agents. You have to do your utmost. You have to wear it on your forehead to be impartial. That's the whole point of our judicial system. That's why every courthouse in this country has Lady Justice with the balance scales and the blindfold, is because everybody in that system is supposed to be impartial. Now, we're human. We're fallible. We're not always perfect in that regard, but it is incumbent on us, and it's incumbent to our oath to the Constitution to be impartial like that. So right off the bat, when we see these things and it's like immediate, this is wrong, and okay, can I articulate why it's wrong? In every instance that we have provided to Congress, the answer is yes. We have a reasonable belief of this wrongdoing, mm-hmm. you know, whatever it is, whatever protective disclosure we made. So we're not supposed to be retaliated against that. Steve mentioned it. Even in my interview, when I showed up to my new unit in Virginia, they brought up things that I made protected disclosures about and accused me of leaking them to the media. Well, they said some other employee made the allegation. Hmm. They were just here to ask me about it. So I'd like them to square that circle. They still haven't 20 months later, 20 months from when their investigation started. Mm-hmm. But I said, no, I made protected disclosures. And they said, oh, this has nothing to do with that. Hmm. And so then they suspend your clearance. I mean, right there. And then they talked to me a little bit. And I'm like, no, I didn't do that. That wasn't me. I did make protected disclosures to Congress. Well, then they seize your gun. Their mind has been made up. And the whole time I'm thinking, you're retaliating against a whistleblower. That is illegal. And still, all these many months later, nobody has been held accountable.
So, Garrett, their justification for suspending you was the claim that you had leaked information to the media, sensitive information to the media.
Correct.
Okay. Yep. Okay. So when we hear these stories, I'm thinking of various cases. We've seen the situation with the memo that the FBI came out with that cited the Southern Poverty Law Center and raised concerns over Latin Mass Catholics. And Steve, I know that situation you're familiar with. I mean, at the end of the day, when we're seeing these situations play out and the public's becoming more and more aware, what's the remedy?
I think ultimately there needs to be a massive reform, if not outright dismantlement of what the FBI has. And I'll even cite back to this radical traditional Catholic memo. What people don't know, have a real full understanding of, is the FBI is broadly interpreting its national security mandate. And when it came to that memo, they took far left sources and laundered them into the FBI's intelligence office. Intelligence analysts drafted this report. And that leads to then assessment or maybe a full investigation. And it's a way that the FBI can circumvent its own caveat to not investigate First Amendment protected activity like religious worship or speech. And the narrative was being set then, over a year ago, that there was a category of white Christian nationalism. And it was sort of brushed under the rug and swept away because the intelligence report was revealed. But that's the hack. The FBI is going to say, we can't investigate religious activity, but if it's refracted through racially motivated violent extremism, which is a subcategory of domestic terrorism, we can do that. And now what we're seeing is the exact same playbook being revealed again. They've slightly changed the term. They don't say white Christian nationalism. They say Christian nationalism, but it's the exact same playbook. And they're using these quote-unquote nonpartisan 501c3 think tanks that are generating surveys and reports, like the Public Religion Research Institute, that says 40% of Americans are adherents or sympathizers with Christian nationalism. And although people who attend church and maybe consider themselves Christian, and they hold consistent beliefs regardless of whether or not they're white, black, green, orange, purple, all those beliefs are refracted through white supremacy. And now we have the hack again. And the FBI can launder that information as a nonpartisan study. It will go through the media, as there are media reports of it now, and they'll say, well, now it's been double sourced. Now the media is reporting on this exact same thing. And that will be all collected to generate an intelligence bulletin, intelligence report, and then germinate a FBI assessment or investigation of an American for their protected religious beliefs. And you can bet that The FBI is going to use the same investigatory tradecraft that it typically uses in terrorism cases, which is they find a vulnerable person, someone who's got an emotional disturbance, someone who's got a financial problem. Now we're seeing an increased attack and targeting on people who are autistic and maybe even minors online who are angry and in chat rooms, and the FBI will use an undercover or an informant to poke them and provoke them and get them obsessed with a certain idea and then groom them for a number of years until they hit the age of majority, in which case then they come at their house and arrest them as providing material support to terrorism. This is all the same exact playbook run, and it's been run for the last 2.5 decades since 9/11.
Garrett, what is driving this? Is the problem a person, a group of people? Is it the structure? Who or what is making these calls?
I think overall the driving factor is cowardice, because all of the people, well, at least all of the FBI agents, and I think analysts too, we swore an oath to the Constitution. And I don't think people really mean that. And then when you're getting pushed from the top, from your supervisor, who's getting pushed from their supervisor, who's getting pushed from their supervisor, who's getting pushed from headquarters, which Steve told me last night that 1/5 of the FBI is located at the headquarters level. And we know from working in the FBI that, and also now from the retaliation as whistleblowers, the headquarters level is completely captured. They are ideologically captured. And you can see it. Just go on at FBI on Twitter, or at FBI jobs, or any of the FBI field offices. They all have their own Twitter account, and just go and see the things they post. There are people here who have names who are doing this. I don't know who they all are. Of course, yes, there are many at the headquarters level who are pushing this down. You know, we know about a year ago at headquarters, there was an LGBTQ plus flag in or on the office of one of the conference rooms, but no American flag. So, go ahead.
And I would say also at headquarters, they have the security division. And we had another whistleblower come forward. And that's the office that suspended our clearances and did investigations forever against us. And we know that they canvassed for between 100 and 300 agents to come to Washington on a temporary basis to join the security division to investigate people within the agency who fit the profile of a whistleblower. They're going after their own. Now, the profile of a whistleblower, according to this whistleblower, is someone who they believe to have conservative political beliefs, a military veteran, someone who had lots of children, or who attended regular religious worship. Now, if the FBI is willing to do that and mobilize all of its assets and resources against one of their own, what are they willing to do against the regular American citizen?
Yeah, and I'll harken back to our field trip to the Holocaust Memorial Museum. Mm-hmm. The whole point of that was to say, look what humans are capable of doing to one another. You are supposed to stand in the gap to prevent that. And here we have all of the FBI not standing in the gap, just doing what they're told, following their orders because, well, you know, I have a mortgage to pay. Yeah, so did we. Mm-hmm. But it means more to uphold America, uphold American values, and do what is right for your fellow man than it does to just, well, my boss told me to. Mm-hmm. But so many are so afraid. And Steve mentioned the Christian nationalism thing. I bet the FBI, because I'm sure they follow, would claim I am a Christian nationalist because my faith is the crucial aspect of why I'm even sitting here today. Mm-hmm. When I got suspended, I had the quote-unquote opportunity to appeal the FBI's decision. The appeal, of course, went to the FBI itself. So what do you think they did? They ratified their own decision, but in the written portion of my appeal, because there's a verbal one as well, I included James 4:17, which says, for him who knows the right thing to do and fails to do it, it is sin. It is sin. So How do I get up in the morning and say, I know the FBI is doing all these wrong things, but I got a mortgage to pay, but I like my job, but my pension's coming in 15 years. I mean, I would be sinning against God. I would be sinning against my nation. I would be basically burning my oath. And I would be being a bad example to my wife and children. And so they can say whatever they want about me. The people who have come up with this notion of Christian nationalism don't even know what a woman is. So why would I let them define what I am?
You guys are speaking out regularly on this topic. Tell us, how can we keep up with you? You all have a podcast. Share with us. How do we follow your work?
Well, Garrett and I have a podcast on that You can get the audio, obviously, on iTunes and Spotify and all the streaming services. It's on Rumble. It's called the American Radicals Podcast, rumble.com/amradpod. We've got a nice little image of the Hamilton image, but he's waving around an M4 carbine, and just so that we can be updated. And I guess our goal is to maybe be on the watch list for the FBI with that title as maybe an angry militia violent extremist group. But we do that every Tuesday, Thursday, and Saturday, and people can live stream at 8:30 Eastern weekdays and noontime on Saturdays, or you can always just catch up and watch it as it's been pre-recorded.
Excellent. And again, Steve, I'll pitch your book. Make sure to pick up a copy, True Blue, My Journey from Beat Cop to Suspended FBI Whistleblower. Garrett O'Boyle and Stephen Friend, thank you both so much for your time. We really appreciate it.
Thank you.
And with that, that's going to do it for today's episode. Thanks so much for being with us here on the Daily Signal podcast. If you haven't had the chance, make sure that you check out our evening show. It's right here in the same podcast feed where we bring you the top news of the day. And take a minute to hit that subscribe button so you never miss out on new shows from the Daily Signal podcast. And also, if you would, leave us a 5-star rating and review. Thanks again for being with us this Friday. We hope you have a great rest of your day. We'll see you right back here at 5 p.m. for our top news edition before we head into the weekend.
The Daily Signal podcast is made possible because of listeners like you. Executive producers are Rob Bluey and Kate Trinko. Hosts are Virginia Allen, Brian Gottstein, Mary Margaret Olihan, and Tyler O'Neill. Sound design by Lauren Evans, Mark Guiney, and John Pop. To learn more or support our work, please visit dailysignal.com.